from the White House, in the nation's capital, Mrs. Lyndon B. Johnson.
Good evening. Welcome to Washington, your city as well as mine. This White House and the nation's capital belong to all Americans. During this hour, you will see something of this great city, its beauty and its promise. The capital of a nation should be the expression of the country's soul. Our capital should symbolize the ideals, the hopes, the greatness, which is the spirit of America. Let me show you. All presidents look upon this view. They think over it. They draw strength from it. From here, they look upon two of the great touchstones of our nation's spirit. The Washington Monument, as simple as that great man, as straight and unbending as our national will to liberty. The Jefferson Memorial, which recalls that great president and the inspired strength of his words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." And though the trees hide it from here, they feel the presence of the Lincoln Memorial, a statement in marble that the nation is one and indivisible. What a lovely view from this room, and what a spread of the nation's history. This is part of the Washington I want to show you, a city of monuments and landmarks. But above all, Washington is the home of people, and like most cities today, badly in need of help. The passage of time, the changing needs of increasing populations, and even progress have littered our cities with a debris of ugliness, which does not have to exist. Not in the nation's capital, not in any city or town in this land. Let me confess that I'm in love with Washington, and most of all at dawn, when the early sun first touches its monuments and landmarks. Then man's work and sky stand in graceful balance, and everywhere is that sense of serenity and peace, which is the greatest gift of beauty. At this hour, one stands surrounded by the ideals and hopes of generations past made real. Around you, the city wakes. Embassies and legations, more than 100 of them. At the Marine Barracks, the hour is struck for morning colors. The flags rise all over the city. 50 flags surround the Washington Monument, one for each state in the nation. The doors to the Supreme Court are pushed open, and the Capitol's working day is begun. Now the working citizens pour into the city. It is a morning tide and a nightly exodus. They bring the most varied talents. Diplomats and secretaries, agronomists, financiers, administrators and scientists, architects and businessmen, soldiers, builders and historians, legislators and statesmen. Their cars fill almost every available space. Then there are the visitors. 9 million tourists come to the nation's capital every year. more people come to visit Washington than any other capital in the world. What they see is a city very young in the terms of history. Less than 200 years ago, most of this land was a swamp, interrupted here and there by a tobacco farm. They see the Potomac River. Most of them travel a few miles downstream to a great plantation, which was standing here long before the national capital was even an idea. It is one of our most historic sites, the home of one of the greatest of Americans. This is Mount Vernon, George Washington's home. It is not part of the District of Columbia. We are about 12 miles south of the city of Washington now. But this home and its surroundings are supremely important in the history of the Capitol. Congress selected the general area for the new Capitol, but it was Washington who, knowing and loving this land, chose the precise spot. But Mount Vernon is perhaps most important as an example of what were the preferences and tastes of our founding fathers. These they made part of the plans for the new city they were designing. Graceful buildings, classical and simple. Large expanses of green which enhance the majesty of large trees and rest the eye and give one the sense of spaciousness and freedom. They appreciated the natural blessings of a great river like the Potomac, not only as a watercourse, but as a source of great beauty and peace. Those are the hills of Maryland on the other side, and they are very much as they were in Washington's day. These founding fathers were lovers of beauty, men of taste, who thought that it would be difficult to improve upon nature. In their own opinion, the capital city had to be not only grand and monumental, but must afford space for nature, green, plants, and the unobstructed view of the sky. What a noble project, and what a lovely sight. But how empty it must have been. Then, in the year 1800, the government and its total of 131 federal employees moved from Philadelphia to the banks of the Potomac. There was Georgetown, and there was a plan. Washington is the first capital city in history entirely laid out before it was built. A French architect, Pierre L'Enfant, conceived it, and on paper drew lines for noble avenues, great buildings, and parks. Some call the swampy site a howling, malodorous wilderness, but that did not stop them. Soon Congress had its first building. In 1807, the President's house looked like this. Then came the War of 1812. The British burned most of the government buildings. This was the low point in the Capitol's history, barely begun and already destroyed. Some thought the Capitol should be moved elsewhere, but Congress decided to rebuild it on the same spot. The President's house took shape and was changed and rechanged. By 1850, the new Capitol building had three domes. Already, some streets were paved. By 1871, Washington was the capital of a nation which had survived the Civil War and spanned the continent. In the 1890s, a century after its birth, Washington was on the way to fulfilling much of the promise of its original conception. It was still dominated by the Capitol, as had always been intended. It stands atop Jenkins Hill, which Lanfranc called a pedestal waiting for a monument. The Capitol is more than a monument. It is one of the busiest working buildings in Washington. Legislators, constituents, tourists, the Capitol embraces them all.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're standing in front of the dome of the Capitol, and it is the center of the street planning of Washington, and it stands majestically higher on the skyline of Washington than any other building.
There is a regulation in Washington that no building anywhere near this zone can be any higher than the Capitol. Any American citizen can climb these steps and go inside to see his representative or his senator. President Lincoln understood what this building meant to this city and to the nation. When he was inaugurated, they were working on the Capitol Dome, changing it from the old one, which was copper, to this one, which is cast iron. Now, some of his advisors thought that with the Civil War and all its tragedies, it would be wise to stop the work. But President Lincoln refused. And while there were battles in Virginia and Pennsylvania, the work on the Capitol Dome went on until it was finished. It was a sign of the nation's faith in its own great future.
For more than 25 years, this building has been an important, even a central part of my life. And yet I'm never near it, but that I'm thrilled. It seems to live and breathe with a life of its own, and it is the life of the nation. Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol is the White House. It is such a lovely house, more beautiful, I think, in our own day, because we enjoy the full measure of the love and care that has been lavished on this national heritage. Its grace is marvelously set by the grounds and gardens which surround it. This is the south lawn of the White House. Before the White House was built, it was a farm, and something of the farm lingered on. Many presidents have had vegetable gardens here on the South Lawn. And only 55 years ago, President Taft kept a milk cow named Pauline Wayne. And in the days of the First World War, President Wilson had a flock of sheep. But very early in its history, presidents began to plan to make this lawn more beautiful. President Thomas Jefferson, that many-faceted man, designed these mounds to add grace and charm to what was a level plain. Many presidents have planted trees, partly to add to its beauty, and partly, I think, to leave something of themselves here. There is the Magnolia grandiflora that President Andrew Jackson brought from his home, the Hermitage, in Tennessee. It's flourished and bloomed there for over 130 years. You know, he planted it in memory of his wife, Rachel, who died after he was elected, but before he was inaugurated. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt planted this little leaf linden tree, and President Eisenhower planted this pin oak tree. Oaks have been great favorites all over the lawn. President Kennedy, who was much concerned with beauty, planted these Magnolia solangianas, one at each corner of the Rose Garden. They'll be here for a long, long time. President Johnson and I planted that young Darlington live oak. We wanted to find something that reminded us of our part of the country. So this park, all of it, is the legacy of the presidents. Now we are working to extend the kind of beauty we find here to the great city which surrounds these grounds. It is a work for the future. But then, that is the definition of hope, isn't it? The certainty that there will be a future and that it can be more beautiful because of some little thing we of the present have done. I sometimes think that the city of Washington itself is a monument to hope. A great city, grandly conceived and planned by a young nation as yet unsure it could survive. It is a city whose monuments symbolize the nation's ideals. The Washington Monument for Liberty. The Supreme Court, our national guarantee of equal treatment to all under law. The National Art Gallery, expressing our conviction that art can flourish in democracy. The Library of Congress, the largest library in the world, our dedication to the advance of knowledge. In Washington, the nation remembers long beyond the memory of man. Washington remembers its great men. President Kennedy, resting in Arlington Cemetery, overlooking the city he loved. Jefferson Memorial. Inside, the bronze statue stands, surrounded by the legends of his own inspiring words spoken in the cause of liberty. Perhaps as much as a monument to hope, this city is a monument to determination. A great deal of the land you see here was reclaimed from the river and is man-made. If Washington is a monumental city, it is also the home of people, and it is they who make the city, they and their work and their lives. Like every other city, Washington is growing faster than anyone even 50 years ago could have thought possible. Our whole nation is growing. In the Department of Commerce building, the Bureau of the Census has a machine which gives one an idea of how fast we grow.
We call this the census clock. It's simply an automatic counting device that indicates how our population is growing. As you can see, the population now is 195,616,787. And while we're standing here watching and talking, you see the number keeps changing. They change about once every 12 seconds. That indicates one person has been added to the population of the United States every 12 seconds. That means five new Americans every minute. It adds up to about 2.5 million new Americans every year. We expect that by about the year 2000, there will be more than 300 million people living in the United States. We've reached the point where more than 70% of the American population now lives on just 1% of the land. More than 70% of the people on 1% of the land. Now, Washington is the center city of one of the largest and fastest growing metropolitan areas in the United States. About 800,000 people in Washington proper, about 2.3 million in the whole metropolitan area, and we expect that by 1980 there'll be 4 million people or so. As our national population grows and as people tend to crowd together into metropolitan areas, that produces problems of many different kinds.
Think of it, 70% of the people on 1% of the land. During the last 50 years, we seem to have grown so fast that we have been careless of how we grew. Take Washington's Potomac River. It is such a great river. And how polluted it is. Few rivers are so important in our nation's history as the Potomac. Almost 300 years ago, Captain John Smith explored the river well beyond this point. He reported it magnificent, and so filled with sturgeon and other fish that, lacking nets, he and his men had tried to catch the fish with a frying pan. Upstream from Washington, at the falls of the Potomac, the river still looks wild and magnificent. It is easy to understand the hold it has always had on whoever lived along its banks. President John Quincy Adams and his family used to swim in it, he almost every day. Only the foolhardy swim in it now. Since the early part of this century, each year it has become a little more polluted. And it is many a year since the sturgeons of Captain John Smith's memory have come upriver to spawn. Sturgeons are very choosy fish. Yet it seems to me that any city would be grateful for a flowing, clean rough course. Beautiful to look upon, restful to contemplate, an infinite opportunity for healthy sports and relaxation. At long last, Washington has begun reclaiming its Potomac River. It is a big project, but I am sure it will succeed. And who knows? Then the sturgeon may even return to their ancient haunts. Other problems seem harder to solve.